Welcome back to another Ghosts of the Pacific edition of Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 122, Tales from Punch Bowl, Part 2. Last week, we heard the story of four very different individuals. An astronaut, an Olympic weightlifter turned professional wrestler turned Bond villain, a world-famous, at least in the botanical world, horticulturalist turned Sinaloa drug cartel smuggler, and the godfather of modern American tattooing. All military veterans, and all laid to rest at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. Today, I want to share four more stories about veterans whose lives were quite distinct from one another. Since we ended with a local Hawaii icon, tattooist Sailor Jerry, last time, I wanted to start this episode with another local icon, restaurateur Don Beach. This other icon story also begins far from the beautiful islands of Hawaii. Ernest Raymond Gant was born on February 22, 1907, probably in New Orleans, Louisiana, and grew up in Limestone County, Texas, though some sources say he was born in Texas. Gant himself remembers spending time in Louisiana and Texas in his youth, as well as then Crown Colony, Jamaica. By his own account, beginning at age 16, he helped his mother run a boarding house in Texas, but claims to have left home at 20 and traveled the world for a year or two. He eventually returned to Texas, but didn't stay long. He left again in 1929, working for the captain of a yacht sailing for Sydney, Australia, by way of Hawaii. After reaching Australia, he spent at least another year island hopping on freighters throughout the South Pacific. When Prohibition ended in the United States in 1933, Gant opened a bar in Hollywood, California called Don's Beachcomber. With its success, he began calling himself Don the Beachcomber and legally changed his name to Don Beach. A former Los Angeles councilman alleged that one reason behind the name change was to distance himself from past bootlegging activities and the operation of an illegal speakeasy called Ernie's Place. At his new legitimate business, he mixed potent rum cocktails he called Rum Rhapsodies. One of the first such cocktails he invented was the Sumatra Kula. The rum-laden and potent zombie cocktail may be his best-known drink. It quickly grew in popularity, and a copy of it was served at the 1939 New York World's Fair by Monty Proser, later of the mob-connected Copacabana nightclub in New York. Proser continued to steal Beach's ideas, opening his own Beachcomber restaurant on the East Coast. Such imitation of Beach's work was common. Don Beach is generally credited with establishing the entire tiki drink genre, creating dozens of other recipes such as the Cobra's Fang, Tahitian Rum Punch, Three Dots and a Dash, Navy Grog, and many others. Beach's drink menu often featured up to 60 different cocktails. Because of post-prohibition laws, food also had to be served at his bar. His customers ate what seemed like wonderfully exotic cuisine at the time, but were actually standard Cantonese dishes served with flair he called South Seas Island food. The first poo-poo platter, today defined as a tray of American, Chinese, or Hawaiian food consisting of an assortment of small meat and seafood appetizers, was probably served at Don the Beachcomber's, as was Rimaki, an hors d'oeuvre of tiki culture origin, consisting of water chestnuts and chicken liver wrapped in bacon. It appears that Beach invented the name for Rimaki. It may have been a shortening of Harumaki, the Japanese word for spring roll. The restaurant was decorated in a tropical island motif with bamboo and materials he had accumulated from his travels in the Pacific and work on movie sets. In trying to create an escapist atmosphere, he even had the sound of fake rain falling on his roof incorporated into the bar with lays for his customers. An early motto of the restaurant was, "If you can't get to paradise, I'll bring it to you." The Beachcomber was popular with Hollywood actors, some of whom were frequent visitors and became friends, including Marlena Dietrich, Bing Crosby, Clark Gable, and Vivian Leigh. As the bar continued to grow in popularity with celebrities, monogrammed bamboo chopstick cases were made for them to make them feel more at home. In the 1930s, Beach married Sunny Sund, a waitress and aspiring entrepreneur from Minnesota. She would eventually become his business partner and manager, enlarging and professionalizing the restaurant. They divorced in 1940, the same year she opened a Beachcomber branch in Chicago. She ran and expanded both the Hollywood and Chicago locations during World War II while Beach was in the service between 1942 and 1945. And speaking of the war, Beach was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Air Corps. He was awarded a meritorious Bronze Star for setting up small rest camps for combat-weary airmen of the 12th and 15th Air Forces in Capri, Nice, Cannes, the French Riviera, Venice, the Lido, and Sorrento. At the order of his friend and Ghost of Arlington, who will definitely get his own series in the near future, Lieutenant General James Doolittle. Yes, that Jimmy Doolittle. To go along with these R&R camps, Beach also created a few Army Air Force themed cocktails, because of course he did. One was called the Test Pilot, and the other, the QB Cooler. QB stood for Quiet Birdman, which was short for Ye Ancient and Secret Order of Quiet Birdman, a fraternity of male aviators dating back to World War I. In addition to the Bronze Star, he also received a Purple Heart when he was injured during a U-boat attack while he was traveling on a ship around the Mediterranean. A B-26 bomber was named Don the Beachcomber in his honor, with his likeness painted on the plane's nose. It was shot down over France a week before D-Day. The crew safely bailed out, but were immediately captured and held as prisoners by the Germans for 11 months before being liberated by advancing Allied troops. After the war, tiki restaurants enjoyed a tremendous burst of fad popularity from the mid-1940s into the 1950s, and several Don the Beachcombers opened around the country to meet that demand. Another restaurateur, Victor Bergeron, had opened a competing tiki restaurant in San Francisco in the late 1930s called Trader Vic's, and the two men were off and on amicable rivals for several years. Both Don and Vic claimed to have created the Mai Tai, a popular rum and fruit juice-based cocktail that Beach said was a knockoff of his World War II QB Cooler. In 1945, Beach signed control of the restaurants over to his ex-wife Sunny, who had been operating them since the start of World War II, though he remained as a consultant and figurehead. As part of the settlement, he was not allowed to open any new Don the Beachcombers in the United States. Under the continued management of Sunny, at its height, Don the Beachcomber had 16 locations nationwide and was one of the country's first themed restaurant chains. Her popular Chicago location was named one of the 50 top restaurants in the U.S. in 1947. That location in particular had also become entangled with mafia associates, leading some to believe the Beach had been forced out of the business, in part by the mob. During this era of increased popularity, Beach created his first Polynesian village at his own Encino, California ranch, where he continued to entertain Hollywood celebrities with extravagant luaus. In the mid-1950s, Beach relocated to the territory of Hawaii, where he was able to legally continue his tiki-themed enterprises, and where he opened his second Polynesian village, known as Waikiki Village, which included the International Marketplace. Today, the International Marketplace is an open-air, fairly high-end shopping center at the heart of Waikiki Beach. But it looked very different when it first opened in 1956. Beach opened a new Don the Beachcomber location there, and the Dagger Bar, allegedly named for a dagger he brought back as a trophy from World War II, a reproduction of an Imperial Roman-style puglia. In addition to the restaurant and bar, several other buildings were opened, meant to represent small villages from Korea, China, Japan, and the South Pacific. By the 1960s, the International Village's popularity reached its height with several other restaurants and bars opening, three of which were owned by Beach, as well as nightclubs and 50 shops. Iconic Hawaiian pop musician Don Ho was a regular performer at many of these locations. As the International Marketplace flourished, Beach's personal contributions to the burgeoning Hawaiian tourism industry were recognized as profoundly important. He was honored with a House Resolution Tourism Award in 1957. He and a few other entrepreneurs played important roles in establishing preservation laws for the Lahaina Historic District on the island of Maui, which was later designated as a National Historic Landmark in 1962. Beach remarried in the early 1960s to a Costa Rican woman named Carla. That relationship was described as tempestuous and harmful for Beach's business, and they eventually divorced. She later became an actress and adopted the stage name Carla Beachcomber. After the divorce, Beach met and married Phoebe, a younger woman from New Zealand of partial Maori ancestry. He built an elaborate houseboat, the Marama, a prototype for what he hoped would be floating housing in Hawaii, but failed to get the necessary zoning permits. He eventually shipped the houseboat to Mo'orea, a volcanic island in French Polynesia, just a few miles northwest of Tahiti, where he lived in retirement with Phoebe for many years before a succession of hurricanes destroyed the boat and the couple returned to Hawaii. Army Lieutenant Colonel Don Beach, aka Don the Beachcomber, the creator of tiki culture and the father of the Mai Tai, died on June 7, 1989 of liver cancer in Honolulu, Hawaii, and was buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Section B, Grave 1 Charlie. He was 82 years old. John Edward Chivini was born in Dyer, Indiana, to Quebecois parents. His father served in the U.S. Army and was stationed in New York during World War I, and the couple stayed in the United States after the war. Shavini attended Catholic grade school in Dyer before moving to Hammond, Indiana, where he attended Hammond High School and where he played football and graduated as class president in 1924. After high school, Shavini played football for Notre Dame University and became part of the legend of Fighting Irish football. He played halfback for three seasons, 1926 to 1928, for storied Notre Dame football coach Newt Rockne, who won his first of three national championships in 1924, but had struggled to recapture the same success. The 1928 season, Rockne's 10th as Notre Dame head coach, was by far his worst season. The team finished just 5-4, but the Irish's game against then-powerhouse Army on November 10th lives on in college football lore. The Irish were losing to undefeated Army 6-0 at halftime, at a game being played at Yankee Stadium in New York City. During the break, Rockne told his players the story of the tragic death of George Gipp, Notre Dame's All-American halfback who passed away in 1920 at age 25 from strep throat and pneumonia just before the end of his senior season. As the legend goes, Gipp was dying when Rockne came to visit him in the hospital. That day, the player told his coach, "I've got to go, Rock. It's all right. I'm not afraid. Sometime, Rock, when the team's up against it, when things are wrong and the breaks are beating the boys, tell them to go in there with all they've got and win just one for the Gipper. I don't know where I'll be then, Rock, but I'll know about it, and I'll be happy." Rockne had never shared those specifics of that day with any of his players before, but chose that particular game against Army to use it to try and rally his team. As Notre Dame came out to play in the third quarter, Shavini scored a touchdown to tie the game, and as he crossed the goal line, he allegedly yelled, "That's one for the Gipper." As he did, the legend of the Gipper was born. Notre Dame would score one more touchdown before time ran out and miraculously beat the Army Black Knights, arguably the best team in the nation, 12-6. This would go down in history as the Gipper game. Shavini became an assistant coach under Rockne in 1929 and 1930 as he finished his law degree. The team went undefeated both those seasons and won back-to-back national championships. He received his law degree in 1931 and left the school shortly after Rockne's death in a plane crash before the 1931 football season. In 1932, he landed an NFL head coaching position for the Chicago Cardinals, but after a lackluster 2-6-2 record, he left the NFL to coach at St. Edward's University, a sister school of Notre Dame in Austin, Texas. When the University of Texas began looking for a new coach in 1934, they hired Shavini, and he led the Longhorns to a 7-6 victory over his alma mater Notre Dame at their home in South Bend, Indiana, during the second game of that season. Texas finished the year a respectable 7-2-1. The 1935 and 36 teams didn't do as well, and Shavini finished his three-year tenure at Texas with a 13-14-2 overall record. He was the only University of Texas coach to have an overall losing record until Charlie Strong ended his three-year tenure in 2016. In 1937, Shavini resigned his Texas coaching position and was appointed Deputy Attorney General of Texas. Following that, he worked in the Texas oil industry. In March 1943, the 36-year-old Shavini was drafted into the U.S. Army. He had tried to enlist earlier but had been rejected due to a knee injury from his college football days. He completed basic training at Fort Benjamin Harrison in Lawrence, Indiana, after which he was assigned to Fort Lawton in Seattle, Washington, a training and staging base for soldiers headed to the Pacific. A corporal, he was granted a transfer to the U.S. Marine Corps and honorably discharged from the Army 3 months after he was drafted. He was directly commissioned a Marine Corps first lieutenant the day after his discharge from the Army, after which he was immediately put on a Marine Corps recruiting poster wearing his summer officer service uniform. After a short stint as a recruiter in Seattle, he was transferred to Officer Indoctrination and Physical Training Schools at Camp Pendleton, California. In September 1943, he left California for Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where he continued as a physical training instructor. He was also the assistant coach of the camp football team. In late 1943, he requested an overseas combat assignment. In January 1944, he found himself at Camp Tarawa, Hawaii, and began training for the amphibious assault of Iwo Jima. He eventually joined the 27th Marine Regiment, 5th Marine Division. He traveled with his unit to Iwo Jima aboard the attack transport USS Rutland. The 27th Marines landed on Iwo Jima at sites known as Red Beach 1 and Red Beach 2 on February 19, 1945. That battle's D-Day. Shavini was one of several hundred Marines and Navy corpsmen killed in action that first day of the battle on 7 color-named and numbered landing zones, each 550 yards wide, that together stretched for 2 miles, just over 3 kilometers of beach, on the southeast side of Iwo Jima. Marine Corps First Lieutenant Jack Shavini, who helped win one for the Gipper, was buried in the 5th Marine Division Cemetery on Iwo Jima, and his remains were later transferred to the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, where they now rest in Section C, Grave 508. He was 38 years old. Another legend surrounding Shavini is that he had been given a fountain pen with the inscription, "To Jack Shavini, a Notre Dame boy who beat Notre Dame," following the Shavini coach Texas Longhorns upset of the Fighting Irish back in 1934. On September 2, 1945, the pen was supposedly discovered in the hands of one of the Japanese officer envoys at the surrender of Japan on the battleship USS Missouri. The pen was confiscated, sent back to the U.S., and the inscription changed to read, "To Jack Shavini, a Notre Dame boy who gave his life for his country in the spirit of Old Notre Dame." This legend, which surfaced in 1945 in conjunction with the anniversary of the Notre Dame Army Win One for the Gipper game, has been a part of Fighting Irish lore ever since. And just like any good legend, no one in the Shavini family has seen or can confirm the existence of the pin or that the inscription was changed. Hua Kao Kong was born on January 17, 1919 in Honolulu, Hawaii. One of 5 children, he graduated from McKinley High School in 1936. After high school, he studied chemistry at the University of Hawaii and graduated with honors in 1940. While at university, he swam, ran track, played basketball, and took flying lessons. Kong was working toward his master's degree in chemistry when he volunteered for military service in 1942. He recorded the highest national score on his entrance exam and was accepted into the Aviation Cadet Training Program. Kong graduated from flight school in May 1943 and became the U.S. military's first Chinese-American fighter pilot. He subsequently trained on the P-39 era Cobra, and on October 23, 1943, he boarded a convoy headed for England. He was assigned to the 353rd Fighter Squadron, part of the 354th Fighter Group at RAF Boxted, flying a P-51 Mustang, which he gave two gloriously politically incorrect names. On one side of the nose, he painted the name Chinaman's Chance, and on the other, No Tiki No Washi, which was a phrase stereotypically attributed to 19th century Chinese laundry workers in the United States and Canada, who would only return a customer's wash when the ticket or receipt was presented. On February 11, 1944, during his 12th mission, Kong claimed his first aerial victory, shooting down a German FW-190 fighter while returning from escorting bombers during a raid on Frankfurt, Germany. His mission was mentioned in Time magazine 2.5 weeks later, but he didn't live to see that. On his 14th mission, Kong was shot down over Bloomberg, Germany on February 22nd. He shared in the kill of a Messerschmitt ME-410 with his squadron leader, and was apparently hit by a stray bullet from that aircraft's tail gunner as Kong finished off the plane. Kong's aircraft exploded and disintegrated in the air. His remains were recovered by the Germans and buried 2 days later. In the summer of 1945, after the end of the war in Europe, his childhood friend, Moom Chang Wong, the second Chinese-American fighter pilot, located Kong's remains, which were then reburied at the Netherlands American Cemetery. Later still, Army Second Lieutenant Hua Kao Kong's remains were moved to the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, where they can be found in Section D, Grave 453. He was 25 years old. Wong, who spent much of his life doing what he could to keep his friend's memory alive, later established the Hua Kao Kong Memorial Scholarship at the University of Hawaii in his honor. Stanley Armour Dunham was born in Wichita, Kansas, on March 23, 1918. In 1926, when he was 8 years old, Dunham discovered his mother's body after she died by suicide. Following that traumatic event, his father put Dunham and his older brother in the care of their maternal grandparents. A rebellious teenager, Dunham allegedly punched his high school principal and spent some time drifting, hopping rail cars to Chicago, then all the way to California and back. Dunham married Madeline Payne on May 5, 1940, and on January 18, 1942, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. He served with the 1830th Aviation Ordnance Supply and Maintenance Company in Europe. 9 months after Dunham enlisted, Madeline gave birth to a daughter, Stanley Ann Dunham, later known as Anne. During the war, Madeline worked at a Boeing B-29 assembly line in Wichita. Dunham was discharged from the Army on August 30, 1945, as a sergeant. After the war, the family moved to Berkeley, California, while Dunham was studying at the University of California. The family later returned to Kansas, where Dunham managed a furniture store. In 1955, the family moved again, this time to Seattle, Washington, where Dunham worked for a few furniture companies until 1960, when his daughter Anne graduated from high school. After Anne's graduation, the entire family moved to Hawaii, where Dunham found better furniture industry opportunities, and Madeline began working at the Bank of Hawaii. In 1970, she was promoted as one of the bank's first female vice presidents. While her parents moved to Hawaii for work, Anne came to attend university. While attending a Russian language class, she met Barack Obama Sr., the school's first African student. At 23, Obama Sr. had come to Hawaii to pursue his education, leaving behind his pregnant wife and their infant son back in Kenya. 18-year-old Anne and Obama Sr. were married on the island of Maui on February 2, 1961, despite parental opposition from both families. At the time of the marriage, Anne was 3 months pregnant and unaware her new husband was already married. Obama told her about his wife in Kenya but claimed they were divorced. It would be years before she learned the truth. Anne gave birth to the couple's only son, future U.S. President Barack Obama Jr., on August 4, 1961 in Honolulu. She then moved to Seattle with her infant son to continue her studies there while Obama Sr. remained in Hawaii. In 1962, Obama graduated from the University of Hawaii and left for Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he began graduate work at Harvard. Anne returned to Honolulu and the university there. During this time, Dunham and Madeline helped care for their grandson. Anne filed for divorce from Obama in January 1964, and he did not contest. In 1965, Anne married an Indonesian surveyor who had come to Hawaii on a grant to study. In 1966, he returned to Indonesia, and in 67, Anne finished her bachelor's degree in anthropology and moved with her 6-year-old son to Jakarta, Indonesia, to rejoin her husband. When he was 10 years old, Obama Jr. moved back in with his grandparents in Hawaii to attend school in the United States while his mother and stepfather remained in Jakarta. In his memoir, Dreams of My Father, Obama wrote that by the time he was 18, I'd arrived at an unspoken pact with my grandparents. I could live with them, and they'd leave me alone as long as I kept my trouble out of sight. Army Sergeant and future presidential grandfather Stanley Dunham died on February 8, 1998 in Honolulu, Hawaii. He was 73 years old. He was buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Section CT1, Row 400, Grave 440. The most famous war correspondent of World War II, an astronaut, an Olympian-slash-pro-wrestler-slash-Bond-villain, a Sinaloa drug cartel mule, the godfather of American tattooing, the father of tiki culture, a college football legend, the first Chinese-American fighter pilot, and Barack Obama's grandfather are just 9 of the 53,000 stories of veterans interred at Punch Bowl. Next time, I will begin the story of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the highest decorated regiment in the history of the U.S. Army, many of whose members have ties to Hawaii and Punch Bowl. I say next time and not next week because of more travel for work that is going to keep me from putting out a new episode next week. So bear with me, and in 2 weeks' time, we will begin to talk about the unit whose motto was Go for Broke. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are pictures related to every episode on the website, www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. You can help others learn about the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.